This episode is brought to you in part by Amanda, Taylor, and Dale. You can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, on with the episode.
It's just one of those things that's like you're involved in that you'll never know the truth. And that's hard to, I think, come to grips with, that you're part of something that you'll really never know the truth about.
Don't matter to me. I used to care, but now... For real, I'm ready to change my name to get out of this shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't want any fucking thing to do with it. Period. Flat. Out. I wish I never would have talked to y'all in the first place.
Is it possible to get to the truth of what happened to Heyman Lee on January 13th, 1999? HBO's four-part The Case Against Adnan Syed thinks it is, and director Amy Berg, who also made West of Memphis, is no stranger to internet-famous cases. And nobody within the sound of my voice is a stranger to men in power taking advantage. Does the 30 for 30 podcast's season on Bikram Yoga tell us anything new on the subject? Namaste, motherfuckers. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 88. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that reviews true crime properties. True crime, not crime. Crime is bad. That's why we don't call it puppies or high fives. Today, I am joined by valued contributor and puppy high five enthusiast, Eve Beatty. Hello again, Eve.
Hello, Sarah. Are you ready to twist your arms like ropes?
I don't think so. Interesting segue, though, I think, into our most wanted section. And a property that perhaps is trying to twist our arms a little bit. We're speaking today about the case of Adnan Syed. I can't imagine that anyone listening to this necessarily needs a case file. But in case you are recently arrived from reverse Rumspringa, here it is. Heyman Lee disappeared after leaving her high school near Baltimore January 13th, 1999. Her body was found in a shallow grave in an area park 6 weeks later, and suspicion soon turned to her ex-boyfriend, Adnan Syed, who was indicted, then convicted of Hayes' murder in 2000. And there the matter rested for most of us, but not for Rabia Chaudhry. I have to have heard this name 600 times, and here I am, unsure how to pronounce it because there is a variation on this last name in the second segment. Anyway, let's leave it at Rabia, a Syed family friend who reached out to journalists she hoped might shed light on what she claimed was a wrongful conviction. And if you're listening to this, you know the rest. Serial, Sarah Koenig, the cell towers, Jay, the Reddit herrings, all of it. Director Amy Berg of, among others, Deliver Us From Evil and Prophet's Prey, takes another deep dive into the case against Syed. The series debuted this past Sunday on HBO and is based, at least in part, on Rabia's book, although that's kind of low-toned in the series, as are a number of other aspects of the case that still make for interesting discussion. Okay, we had screeners of the first three. I watched all three. There are four parts in total. Eve, how many of these did you get around to watching?
I watched them all. I fully watched the first one. And by the middle of the second one, it started to get into like a little bit of condoing with the K and, you know, a little bit of checking Twitter and stuff. And by the third one, I was very in and out.
Well, that leads to my first question, which is how you felt about the series overall, to date anyway. The construction of it, the length of the episodes, the ordering of information. It sounds like you had a diminishing returns issue as things continued. I also felt that the episodes were... I mean, Berg is in an impossible position with this, kind of, because... The story, she has to sort of split the difference for HBO subscribers who aren't familiar with the story, didn't listen to Serial, don't remember all of the details from the podcast, and people who are if not obsessed with the case, extremely well informed. I'm kind of somewhere in the middle, but unfortunately, the episodes did feel a bit long.
Well, I think that, you know, for people who just tuned in starting last night too, as opposed to watching the screeners ahead of time like you and I did, there, she has the additional obstacle to overcome that there were an enormous number of headlines this weekend about Adnan's case and the decision of Maryland's Court of Appeals not to allow him to sort of continue at with his current line of appeal. So, you know, even if you didn't know anything about it, if you follow the news at all, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you saw headlines about the case. So you already have, you know, like a lot of information. And there wasn't a lot of new stuff, in my opinion, in this documentary. And to me, that was, I think, sort of a big problem of it. And so a lot of it felt like fluff to me. For example, I was not a huge fan of the sort of the animated diary stuff that was in the first episode. That said, I also was annoyed that it didn't continue through the second and third. So basically what I'm saying is the food tasted bad and the portions weren't big enough.
Yeah, I did feel like, you know, this is a series that is built expertly, but is also felt a little bit checklisty. There's nothing wrong with doing kind of predictable or stereotypical documentary things. They are predictable and stereotypical for a reason. They work to construct a narrative, but some of it did feel a little bit, not by numbers exactly, but like Rabia walking around in an empty house and just talking about how much time has passed. That just felt very done or expected. I liked the diary entries, and I liked the shots of the diary that we got. Like, you'll see this in the visual aids for this episode, which you can find on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. But I took a screenshot of this picture of her diary where she wrote her new boyfriend's name just over and over in different handwritings and capitalizations like 47 times. And I was like, and here we are at this young lady who was 16, 17. And that was my diary. That may have been your diary. I think that was a very sort of relatable, familiar thing. The extreme drama of high school and the lack of perspective and the going back and forth between two like extremes of feeling in a relationship, the thinking it was exciting to have an older boyfriend in his 20s instead of kind of pathetic for him. All of that was there. And yet, I felt like once again, Heyman Lee started to disappear from this story pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, it seems like that's what they sort of like suggested in the first episode. They sort of led with that, right? That, you know, she gets that the narrative of the victim has gotten lost in this case. And that's something that I think that you and I have talked about before on this show, that so frequently when we're watching a true crime case, the victim is sort of, you know, I don't want to say the punchline, but something like that. Like they're at the very end, they're why the story is happening, but they're not what really what you hear about throughout. So that we had, I don't know, I found the, in my opinion, I agree with you that it did, like it brought back all those like memories of how things felt so important when they really weren't in high school. But the animation, I felt infantilized. And, you know, a certain sense, you know, I felt like this is a person, if she was anything like I was at 16, who wanted to be perceived as an adult and who was excited at the opportunities to do adult things, and to sort of make her forever a child, I feel minimizes the fact that she will never get to be an adult.
Yeah, that's part of it. We definitely have talked, and I feel like I talk about it in almost every episode, that unfortunately, narratively, what often happens in at least a murder, true crime stories about murder, is that the inciting incident on page 2, so to say, is the death of the victim. And it is difficult to keep him, her, or them in sight as you're continuing to unravel or unpack the facts of the case. And because this is called The Case Against Adnan Syed, okay, like I understand what they're trying to do, and I understand that there may not have been a willingness on the part of Heyman Lee's family to participate. I think they got more than Serial did. I'm not clocking Serial for this either, but they did get a lot of Hayes' friends to talk on camera. But I still felt like, you know, first of all, to your point, like she was sort of at that turning point of, you know, girl and woman. And there definitely was more girl, even though it seems like whatever your theory is of her death, it had to do with adult concerns, if that makes any sense. And the other thing is, you know, if this documentary is called The Case Against Adnan Syed, I think that you have to start presenting realistic alternate theories for what happened, or explanations as to why the prosecution's theory of the case is not emotionally correct much sooner and more forcefully than you do, because I think they bring up, like, in episode 3, the problem with these reversals of or like successful appeals before this weekend in Adnan's case is that the family, Heyman's family, is still struggling with the fact that she was killed, and now perhaps they don't know who was responsible. That this comes up so late, I felt was a little bit of a problem. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm not sure how I would do it different. But finding out that Rabia's book was optioned, and then it sort of became this series, makes me feel like, yeah, I don't know if I'm articulating this very well, but I feel like this case needs to be taken on, like, without any source material, as it were,
yeah,
so that we can actually look at it and be like, all right, if, you know, first of all, is the case against Adnan legitimate? And if it's not, what is our alternate theory of the case? And this does not do that, because I think it cannot do that. And perhaps it's unfair of me to expect it to do that.
Well, I think in episode 2, they sort of build up this, you know, sort of like this seeming revelation about Don, like, oh, you know, no one ever really looked at Don. There was, you know, God, what about Don and all this? And then it just, like, it just sort of fizzles out. We go to Don's house. He's not hot. He's disabled. And we, you know, watch some video from far away. And it's like, I felt clickbaited. Like, it seemed like they were leading up to some really awesome Don thing. And I remember, like, in my notes, I said, finally, something besides Jay. And then it sort of went nowhere. And I'm not saying, oh, we need to bend the narrative to fit, like, good storytelling. But then you already know when you're editing this that Don's not going to go anywhere. So just be straight with me. You don't have to red herring me. This isn't a Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, or just push the idea that Don should have been looked at harder. I did feel like in episode 1, there's sort of one of her friends, Krista, I believe her name is. There's a couple Kristas or Christies. I think this actually is Krista. Is talking about high school and sort of the emotional and illogical decisions that you're making. And I pulled a clip of that. So here it is.
You can't make logic out of a teenage life. You just can't. Teenagers are all over the place. You fall in love, you fall out of love, you go back. You think you're old enough to make your own decisions, but then you're not really old enough to make your own decisions. And you make some choices that sometimes are good and sometimes are bad.
I absolutely agree with this. I think the fact that all of these people were in their late teens at the time is very important, not just because of sort of the notorious changeability of the American adolescent, but also because memory is also fungible. And, you know, I wouldn't remember where I was on a given day necessarily, especially not if I were arrested in connection with it 7 weeks later. And now everybody's being interviewed about this 15, 18, 20 years after the fact. And a lot of the things that seemed important on a daily basis when you're a senior in high school were bullshit and have fallen out of your brain. But that specific clip, I felt like they had an opportunity to then say, and the decisions that she was making vis-a-vis, you know, breaking up with and getting back together with Adnan were bad, or and her decision to like leave herself open to the attentions of a 22-year-old was not a good call, or she may have put herself in a position with a as yet unknown third person that was dangerous, yeah, unbeknownst to her, or, I mean, that sounded a little victim blamey. That's not what I meant. Mm-hmm. I just, like, that was an excellent point that was not carried forward, unfortunately, into an alternate theory of the crime that does not include Adnan or Don. And it was a wasted opportunity, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah.
We also talk a lot with, I think, the secondary detective on the case, Daryl Massey.
He's so charming.
Is that sarcasm?
No. I like that guy.
Okay.
I found him very charming. Yeah.
I liked that he did a little pushing back on the things that we snotty commentators think that we know because we've watched so much crime programming. Here's clip three.
I think the trend and the culture of everybody believing the husband did it, the boyfriend did it. If you get in that narrow path of thinking, you only hurt yourself in an investigation. You really do.
That was another one that I thought was an excellent point, that he's saying, you know, investigators need not to get tunnel vision about, in this case, the idea that Adnan didn't want to break up with Hay and, you know, flew into a rage and, you know, killed her in the parking lot of Best Buy during daylight hours. We'll get back to this. We'll get back to the prosecution's theory of the crime in a second. But between that interview and how much time they spend on the idea, which I think can probably be borne out by the facts that Jay was coached into a story that they could retro-engineer and apply to Adnan, but they just don't quite push hard enough on this idea, even though the idea that Jay knows more than he's telling and made up a story is kind of central to the theory that Adnan is innocent.
Well, and then they build up, I mean, this is within sort of the structure of the show. They give us all this stuff like, since then, Jay has, you know, allegedly committed all these crimes, has been arrested all these times, but no one has moved forward with prosecution. And they sort of leave it there. Like, you know, so I'm like, what are you suggesting to me? Are you suggesting that Jay somehow has a future immunity deal with Baltimore's DA, because I find that dubious. Are you suggesting that he knows something and so everyone's afraid and they're going to let Jay get away with things? Because once again, I find that dubious. So it's just like, I feel like exactly, they didn't push hard enough, and at the same time, they sort of brought up stuff and left it in, you know, without going the next step of insinuating. But I'm sort of like, what's your point?
Exactly. I'm going to skip ahead to clip five, which is from the second episode. Rabia is talking about the fact that there were DNA samples in given spots in Hay's car that some did not match Jay or Hay. Others were not tested at all. And then we go into sort of a meditation on the idea that Jay is fundamentally untrustworthy and will throw anyone under the bus. Here's clip 5.
If it didn't match them, they just didn't try anything else. Police officers avoid collecting bad evidence. They don't want evidence that will undermine their case. They've already got a witness saying, I helped bury Haman Lee with Adnan.
I don't know if I'll ever know exactly how he fit into this whole thing from soup to nuts. I don't know that I'll ever feel comfortable that I know that. I'm sure that there was some, you know, self-protection going on there to think that, well, if they're going in the direction of this guy, I certainly don't want them to go into my direction.
If Jay gets pulled over and you're in a car with him, and he's dirty or he feels like there's a chance that he's going to go to jail, he's going to try to dump every responsibility for anything onto you. He'll trade places with you in a heartbeat, which is why people don't talk to Jay anymore.
I kind of enjoyed that guy just being like, yeah, fuck yeah. Jay. Yeah. But on the other hand, much time was devoted to Jay's untrustworthiness, lack of credibility. And here again, I felt, okay, devil's advocate time. What then? What's the theory? Like, why this story? What story do you think he started out with before they started the tape recorder? Because there's another one of Adnan's advocates, Susan. I do not remember her last name. I do remember her top because I wanted it. The white one with the black flower across it.
Yeah, yeah.
Very, very chic. And she was great in interviews, but she sort of dug into not just the cell tower evidence, but also the fact that, you know, these stories and statements, not just from Jay, but from other witnesses from that day, were workshopped basically prior to record being hit on the you know, cassette deck. So let me just play clip 6 real quick and then we'll get back into this.
Well, the most important part of that is that people play with that a lot, meaning non-investigators, culturally in Baltimore. The first story anybody tells you is going to be a lie. Then when they refine that story, it's going to be less of a lie.
We interviewed you originally on the 28th of February. There were a lot of inconsistencies.
Yes.
To start with, you indicated when he calls you that he was at Edmondson Avenue, where he pops the trunk and shows you the remains. That wasn't true.
No, sir.
He actually killed her.
Yes.
At Best Buy.
To my knowledge.
To your knowledge.
Yeah.
You don't turn on the tape recorder until you've got the statement you want.
You don't turn on the tape recorder until you've got the statement you want. Sure. I absolutely believe that that's a thing. I absolutely buy into Rabia saying the police don't want evidence that either doesn't lead anywhere or doesn't support what their working theory of the crime is. I believe that. These are human beings. These investigators, and I'm sure this shit happens all the time just so that people aren't working 19-hour days. It happens. But once, I feel like they just kept proving this point over and over again, to an extent. Would you agree?
I agree, but I also think that, you know, it's what you said earlier. It's that I don't need them to say, you know, I don't need like the last act of Perry Mason. I don't need it. Ha! It was actually this guy. But, and I think that if any single murder investigation where there isn't video and a confession were scrutinized with the level of sort of focus that this case has been scrutinized, that there would be questions and there would be, you know, people will be saying, you know, people, pundits like you and me, will be saying, well, there's reasonable doubt. The fact that this case has been gone over, you know, in so many ways, especially by people who, you know, to your earlier point, haven't thought about this stuff in 20 years, means that there are going to be, just by nature, there are going to be a ton of questions. So I don't know. I just sometimes feel like with this case, with all respect to all the players here, that, you know, there's a lot of sort of, you know, Sturm und Drang that, you know, is manufactured.
Yeah, I have to agree. I did think that there was that reveal about the cell tower. The cell tower data that only certain kinds of calls should be considered a reliable indicator of location. I thought that that was of note. But I also, again, after three episodes in a property called The Case Against Adnan Syed, I think I would rather have seen a slightly more, not unbiased, because I don't think that's necessarily possible for a documentary, or frankly necessary, but perhaps a more just straight ahead, even dry recitation of what the prosecution's case was and whether we should consider this evidence reliable, and sort of going from there. Because this documentary is also kind of like, there's a whole like montage of Serial being this gigantic popular juggernaut that touched off the peak true crime era in which we both find ourselves at the moment. But then the effect of Serial on this case, and that the Heisenberging of everything that's going on, for good or ill, since it premiered, is not really brought up again in a way that's satisfying or relevant. Maybe it comes up again in the fourth episode, but I think the role of Serial and of the internet are critical and have to be included, and perhaps a more of a timeline-based documentary that incorporated Serial's involvement and the way that that changed everyone's priorities a little bit in the case was indicated. Either that, or just don't mention it at all and be like, Serial, what's a Serial? I like cornflakes. I mean, I don't know. Did you feel that they address Serial enough? Or you kind of like, I don't want to hear any more about Sarah Koenig?
Well, no, again? I think it's a dangerous game mentioning Serial when you're these guys, because, you know, Serial was so special in the way that I would argue the first season of Survivor was special. Yeah. That it was, you know, it was such a unique and unreplicable thing that, and everyone's sort of been chasing that dragon or that high since then. So I will tell you, when I heard the Serial music, even during the first episode, like the hair on my arms rose, because I mean, like, you know, even though I'm like, you know, talking about this case and how it's, you know, like what, you know, whatever the case is for me problematic, Serial itself as a piece of work was, I think, you know, such an amazing experience for me as a listener. And I think that so many people feel that way. And so every time you bring up Serial, you're going to look shitty in comparison, you know, like I think that that's, you know, a problem that, you know, as opposed to some of the other problems that Amy Berg was running into, that's a problem that you had to know coming in. Like, you had to out Serial. And these guys didn't, not only in sort of the quality of the experience, but also in revelations of the case. So anytime I even thought about Serial, I thought, well, Serial already handled all this. Why do we need the HBO version of it? Why not? If your goal is to unmask a problematic case, there are so many fucked up cases out there. Serve somebody else who's getting fucked by the system.
There's also the fact that Serial basically was born because Rabia tracked down journalists who had covered the case contemporary with its being tried, and that, you know, Sarah Koenig has always said, this case came to me, not the other way around. I have various issues with Serial's presentation like generally and particularly season three, but season one was, like you said, like absolutely groundbreaking. I was glued to it. People had been telling me to listen to it. I was like, whatever. And then, you know, didn't have my earbuds out for like 8 hours when I finally got into it, and it was great and compelling. But Rabia was in it from the jump, and she's in this from the jump. And this is not to say that there's anything unethical about that or about the storytelling. It's not shady, but a big part of this story is the stories about the story. And I think you either have to like take a position right up top that it's like, we're just going to take this evidence and start from the beginning and not have any advocates or anything else. Like, let's just find the two newborns who have never heard cereal, raise them in a bubble, and then put them on this case. It, you know, it'll be like, you know, 7 Up and 14 Up, but for the, but for the unsaid case. I shouldn't joke about it. It's people's lives. So you have to do that, or I think you have to devote basically an entire episode to being like, here's how we got here in the meta narrative.
Yeah.
Like, you have to divorce it completely, or you have to just bring it in and put it on your lap, because it's too, you can't just be like, well, we all remember cereal. Okay, bye cereal. And then just proceed with this when you are covering a lot of things that were covered in the original podcast, and you're not necessarily bringing anything new to the table. You don't have all that much more involvement from Haman Lee's friends and family. You don't have sort of a late stage confession or reversal from Jay. You don't have video. And with every passing day, clip four,
there's a wide array of things that I could have done after school. Well, you know, we went to the library, or I could have went to get something to eat, or I could have hung out in school somewhere. The exact, like, accounting of hour by hour. I've tried so hard, and the problem is I've read so many different transcripts and interview statements of other people. I don't know what's real and what's not.
I mean,
yep.
You know,
exactly.
Here we all are. This is sort of what I was getting at with the you have to bring cereal in. Because I think there's just like a cloud of information that's like in the air in the culture. So I'm not sure how to handle that. And again, I want to stress, this is not like bad. This is not a shitty way to spend 3 hours. But I just wanted it to be more or more different. And it isn't in the first three. So, you know, it's expertly made. And if you are interested in this case, I think you will get a lot out of it. But for someone like me who was like, hasn't really continued to obsessively follow updates about the case after Serial Season 1, I'm not going to grade it as high, but that's just me. I will say that the, you know, getting back into the case and thinking about the case, the prosecution's apparent theory of what occurred makes less and less sense to me the more often I hear it. I can't remember. I know that past guest Stephanie Green has always been like, yeah, he did it. And I feel like attorneys that I know tend to come down on the side of he's guilty and he's a sociopath and don't be charmed by all of his, you know, phone calls and voiceovers and serial. I never felt that way. And I also feel like the idea that this guy, who A, appeared to sincerely love her, and B, could probably have counted on getting back together with her, would have strangled her in broad daylight in a Best Buy parking lot. I just find that extremely difficult to believe. What's your operating theory of what happened?
I have more like negatives than a positive. Oh, you could, that could be the my memoirs tagline.
mine too, but I lost the coin flip.
But like the problem for me is that every sort of, you know, theory I'm presented about who did it instead is, well, it was Jay, and you know, and Jay just sort of like, you know, dimed Adnan out instead. And I'm like, this, I would find this more believable if Jay were a Brock Turner type, because then it would be, you know, just like straight up racism, right? You know, cops want to go after a Middle Eastern guy, and the other guy is this clean cut white, you know, Stanford swimmer.
Right.
But Jay, you know, Jay came into the story with already seeming like a sketchball to cops at the time. And so it's very unlikely to me that the cops are going to look at Jay and be like, oh, well, it's easier to pin it on the straight A guy when we could go with, you know, the black guy who deals weed. Like,
yeah,
that,
no,
to me,
I
just seems
should
like
say,
such a significant stretch.
Yeah, I don't think Jay did it. I don't know if Jay did anything. I don't know if Jay saw anything, but I don't think Jay did it.
So it's like, I guess keep always go back to, well, who did it? You know, somebody else, there's always the stranger possibility, and I wish that somebody would pursue that more. If this show had been about the number of stranger killings in the area, or, you
right.
know, something else like that, you know, somebody she met at Best Buy or something, I would be very interested in and open to that theory, because I do believe that there are men who just walk around and kill women and don't know them at all. And I do believe that a lot of times those guys get away with it. And so, like, bring me something like that so I have something to work with, because otherwise I am going to believe, because Jay said so, you know, that Adnan did it.
Well, and they just didn't have any better suspects.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure there's evidence that I'm forgetting that is deeply prejudicial or, you know, indicative that Adnan did it. And, you know, you're welcome to remind me of it on social. Once again, Blutter Presents on Facebook and Twitter. But I just kind of feel like, and this is something that Bill James brings up frequently in Popular Crime, that he's like, you have to remember that there are serial killers that are like multiple serial killers active near you at any given time that are not going to be caught.
Well,
period.
I keep going back. If I were more prepared, I would have looked it up. That guy who killed that teenage girl's family and then kept her captive under his bed, that guy had never done anything like that before. He saw that girl at a bus stop and decided to go do that. You know who I'm talking about, right? That recent case where the girl escaped.
Yeah.
Like, this shit happens in America all the time. And
it happened to Chandra Levy, and her body was left close
by.
That's
an excellent example. And
right?
It happens far more frequently. Yeah, yeah, pretty close by. It happens far more frequently to marginalized people.
Yes,
people
exactly.
That, and we don't hear about it and stuff. But, you know, this happens all the time. Serial killers, people who, you know, just want to go once. All of those fucking incels on Twitter, I feel like they have it in them, you know? And so I'm not saying that that's what happened to Hay. I think, you know, Occam's razor, it's probably Adnan. But I do think that that it's just some fucking crazy rando is, you know, a much better possibility than bringing up, you know, Don and Jay for the 500th time.
Yeah. Or that, like, I don't know, put that DNA, like Golden State Killer, that DNA,
yeah.
And throw it in whatever 23andMe and see if anything pops.
Oh, yeah,
I
yeah.
mean, there's problems with that too, but I just kind of feel like there is a, not confirmation bias, but something like confirmation bias, but like Daryl Massey was saying in that earlier clip, that people are like, well, you know, if the boyfriend has any motive at all, or the husband has any motive at all, that's the first place cops look, and sometimes the last place. Like, well, okay. And a lot of the time they're not wrong. Like, in
yeah.
every 48 hours I've ever seen, they're absolutely right to be like, how come you went for a hike with your wife and came back without her, and now you have a girlfriend 2 days later? Like, that's not a completely random theory, or thing to think. But in this case, like, well, in this particular part of the world, like, it's Bodymore Murderland. I shouldn't generalize about Balmer, but I will say that I think it is much more likely than law enforcement was willing to admit that it's just nobody who was on their radar at all.
Sure.
I'm going to tune in for episode 4 because it's one more hour. And I would say if you are interested in this case and you liked Serial, that you will find this interesting and you will like this. But if you are looking for something completely new or for them to go through the case against Adnan Syed from the beginning and just work it like it's the beginning, that's not what they're doing, which I think is a missed opportunity. But, you know, Amy Berg is a pro. It's not poorly done. You just may find it superfluous.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, moving on to our cold case section. Launched their podcast series, I believe 2 years ago now. Where does the time go? Often it's auxiliary material or an audio version of the movies that they're doing on ESPN. But 30 for 30 Bikram was its own season devoted to one story. Here's the case file. This part of Bikram's yogaography per Wikipedia appears to be true. Quote, Bikram developed a 26 posture series by piecing together existing sequences created by Bishnu Charan Ghosh and claims to have created it himself. The 105 degree Fahrenheit heat in which Bikram yoga is practiced is, according to Chowdhury, meant to mimic the climate of India. End quote. Many of Bikram's other claims, yoga prodigy status, winning gold medals in weightlifting, consulting on Hollywood scripts, were not. But by the time the internet came along to disprove them, he'd already collected tens of thousands of marks, adherence, to his style of yoga and the punishing conditions required to benefit from it. Between Bikram's personal charisma and a yoga atmosphere that suggested that suffering, sacrifice, and isolation were part of one's education, Bikram was in an excellent position to groom young women who believed his BS or were afraid to express that they didn't, and then to avail himself of a that's just Bikram atmosphere in which to assault them without consequence. 30 for 30 devoted a mini season of its podcast to Bikram's huckster rise and felonious fall. Hosted by Juliet Lowry Henderson, the season dropped in the middle of last year, but is feeling awfully familiar listening to it now after watching Wild Wild Country, Leaving Neverland, Surviving R. Kelly, and many, many, many other properties devoted to the experiences of people badly burned by power. Eve, this was your selection. Tell us more.
Well, I practice Bikram yoga, let's see, I would say maybe for about a year. The thing is, like everyone says in the podcast, it fucking works. It does. Like, I don't know why there is, like, you know, as they discuss, there isn't, you know, any sort of like comprehensive study on why, but I've never been in a better shape in my life than when I did it, I'd say, you know, for most of 2001. And I, you know, of course, like saw the headlines when people first started making allegations about him. They played especially widely in San Francisco because his very first yoga college before he opened in Beverly Hills was here in the city. And so, like, you know, I've always wondered, like, what the sort of, I've always wanted a sort of comprehensive telling of the story as opposed to like an AP story here and there or whatever. And, was excited to have, you know, a reason to listen to this whole podcast. And I loved it. I was so sucked in and enjoyed it so much. And I thought that it really benefited from not having a sort of chronological or forensic approach to it, but instead sort of approaching it more organically. Sarah, what did you think about how it was sort of overall shaped?
I was a little frustrated by the build, to tell you the truth. I thought that it was very, I liked listening to it. Henderson is a good host. She did extensive research, but it's not too like underliney about that. Like, you know, here's me going all the way to India. Like, she just did the work and it shows. And I think that her choice to bring certain things forward and leave certain things in the background is a choice, but I just like to hear about cons, and I wanted to hear, in addition to the testimony of his victims, I also wanted to hear the ways that he was, the ways that he was conning people. He's referred to frequently in the first couple of episodes as a con artist and a huckster. And you hear from that guy whose name I wrote down and now I can't find it, who basically like brought all of the hot yoga rooms like physically up to code.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like Eric something, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And then once it was clear that he was indispensable to the building department liaison in literally every single city in which there was a practice, Bikram was like, get your shit and get out. And it's like, well, I wanted to hear more about that. I wanted to hear more about the bullying lawsuits that were very Scientology-esque. That Bikram,
what about Raquel
bring...
Welch? I wanted to hear so much more about Raquel Welch.
Oh my God. I know. Like, that's some balls. Balls on her to just take it and be like, here's this video. And then Bikram's like, no, fuck you. I would watch an entire 30. I would watch like a 2-part 30 for 30 on just their legal battle for the visuals alone. Oh my God. That was great. So I did find that a little frustrating, but I also thought that it did a good job of sort of giving you the facts about, and how many times have we seen this now, but, you know, presenting you with yet another situation in which a powerful man and predator sets up a situation over the course of, like, talking about a long con, sets himself up to commit these crimes and to have them absorbed by the community and kind of make everyone culpable for him raping people. And to put the responsibility for avoiding that onto others. And I do think that that's... like we're all sort of exhausted and beaten down by repeatedly getting this information about people that we once admired, but I, you know, it's so important to remember that this is how predators operate. And I thought it did an excellent job of that, but I just thought it should have been longer and a little more strictly chronological, because I just thought there was so much more there and so much more material with which to despise Bikram that I was a little disappointed that we didn't hear more about it. But in clip 7, we do hear about how responsibility for avoiding getting sexually assaulted by Bikram was the responsibility of the prospective victim.
There were people you could tell. There were people you couldn't. And there was a protocol, as unsatisfying as it might be, for how to deal with the problem.
Basically, instead of stopping the man from doing what he's doing or somebody saying something, let's just make sure that all of these women are buddying up so that we can be safe against this man instead of saying anything to anybody. You know, that was the defense. That was the way to deal with the situation.
It sort of reminded me of a previous iteration of Dear Prudence on Slate, getting absolutely and rightly hammered for being like, y'all college girls shouldn't be drinking because that's what gets you raped. Like, no, rapists get college girls raped. Mm-hmm. Fuck you. Anyway.
Well, and I sort of felt like that's why the show sort of built up to the darkest aspects of the con, because I felt like it really wanted to set up, you know, every possible argument against the why didn't she leave sort of crowd.
That's a good point. That is definitely a good point. it also created when that one woman who was telling her story, and was joined by, I think, her teacher, one of her first teachers from Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And the teacher is sort of just learning what had gone on, and creating that, just sort of creating that space for a woman to support her friend and mentee on a, you know, in the middle of this narrative was unusual and quite lovely, I thought. I should warn prospective listeners, if you haven't listened to this yet, and the podcast itself will warn you, the testimony is, you know, unflinching and direct, and yeah, it's difficult to hear. I had pulled a clip of sort of a less bracing part of it, and then I thought, you know, no, let's not go through that again, all of us. But I did pull a clip of this woman who, like, self excommunicated herself from the Bikram community and then began collecting all this testimony via her alternate Facebook group, that a bunch of people are sort of talking about, the relationship that you continue to have with the abuser and how that comes to be, and the grooming that goes into that, and the misunderstanding of that dynamic. Here's clip 8.
People are convinced that you're lying if you go back to your attacker. But there's a lot of reasons why someone would do that in a marriage or a father-daughter relationship. And that's kind of what this felt like to me, was he was like almost like a family member. So I didn't want to destroy the family.
And you look at that in the context of the Bikram yoga community. This is their guru. They loved him. I loved Bikram at one point. Like, you're so caught up in this energy and this love and this community and this little bubble that you're in, that you love this person. And then at some point that love turns into like a security, because you're in the community, you have security, you have a job security. And then you're abused, and then you're confused. But you have to stay there because that's where your money is. That's your false sense of security. And that's your love. So that your love becomes fear, and then becomes, you're convincing yourself that you'll just stay because you love the community.
This is absolutely the best explanation I think I've heard in quite some time. And the most direct about, you know, returning to an abuser, staying with an abuser, the rationalizing of a community to protect or not consequence an abuser, and how the abuser is still responsible for that. I thought that was excellent and difficult, but made the whole thing worthwhile.
Well, I think that, you know, that is something that you hear, to your earlier point on how, you know, seeing Wild Wild Country, Leaving Neverland, and all these other shows, it's that sentiment that we hear again and again. And while, you know, that you're part of a family, you're part of a group, you're part of something that is chosen, and you're so reluctant to rock the boat and, you know, ruin this beautiful thing. We heard this account from people who worked at Uber, which is not necessarily as systematically a messed up place as these other places we're talking about, but people saying that they didn't want to raise concerns at Uber because they liked the perks and we were doing this amazing thing. I think it's just, you know, I think you
heard it from some people at Theranos, yeah. I think, that they're like,
absolutely,
they're, well, yeah,
absolutely,
we really want to make this work and make all of her claims true. And it's a really good idea.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. I think that, you know, we're all capable of being gaslit, and it's not just by, like, you know, a weirdo and a speedo. So I think that, you know, anytime you can put something out there like that and, you know, you're holding up a mirror to a possible situation for everyone, I think that that's like a good thing to throw out there. And I hope that people listen to it.
Yeah, I agree. And it's worth remembering also that, you know, human beings are complicated, and not everybody, like, responses are not off the rack for this kind of thing. But in addition to having, yeah, this, like gradually turning the heat up under the frog thing, and gaslighting, you also have the sunk costs calculation that everyone does. And when it comes to emotions, usually people do them incorrectly or like to sort of penalize themselves in these situations. And it's extremely complicated. And I think we can all point to situations we, quote, should have gotten out of months or years sooner than we did. So, but this was an excellent accounting of that emotional calculus, and was built to quite well, even though, like, I looked at it, like, sort of each episode, I'm like, does this have to be this long? And did we really learn that much? But then the cumulative effect is quite powerful. I also enjoyed in the fifth episode that, like, the firecrackers really start popping in the fifth episode, including when she goes to visit Bikram to try to get an interview, and she has to, like, go for a pre-interview visit to see if she's allowed to have a formal interview, which, spoiler, she isn't. But her account of their interaction is delightfully withering and might remind you of someone. Clip 9.
Let her sit next to me, he said. I know she's not going to sue me for sexual harassment. I was a little nervous, unsure of being on my own in a foreign country with a man accused of violent crimes, and unsure of where the conversation would go. But Bikram immediately started talking and never stopped. He told me he was bigger than Michael Jackson in India, that he cured former Attorney General Janet Reno of her Parkinson's disease, that his appearance on 60 Minutes in 2005 was the highest-rated show in the history of television. I expected to be able to recognize the man that people say he once was, to catch a glimpse of his compassion, his genius. But I didn't. It was pure ego.
Trump, anyone? Like, it just, that Trump, whole sequence was so Trumpy.
Well, and I think, you know, for me, since I live, like, in the Bay Area, it's just, like, every freaking, you know, tech bro, CEO, guy who made a little bit of money and therefore thinks, like, every single idea he has is brilliant, you know, and yet is still, like, reciting his resume to waitresses. I mean, it's just, like, it's Harvey Weinstein. It's all these freaking guys that I think inside know that they are a fraud, and it doesn't matter what they have done, you know, how much money they've made, what they've accomplished, how many people surround them telling them they're great. They're still, you know, monsters inside.
It's just like she has a quote a couple of episodes before that about or it might have been the previous episode, about how some of these claims, like he stopped saying that he'd written a lot of the dialogue for Being There once the internet came along, and a lot of these things could be disproved. But he's sticking with the Janet Reno thing because she has passed away, so nobody can really step to him on that claim. Or, well, I guess he thought it wouldn't be.
He sticks with the I was a yoga champion claim, too, even though towards the end of the series, we learn that he wasn't even, you know, studying with these great gurus regarding yoga. He was instead studying, ironically enough, massage.
Oh, which God.
Did this podcast sort of ruin massage for you? It kind of ruined it for me.
Yeah, it ruined massage itself. It ruined the words massage, masseur, masseuse.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It also alternate pronunciations like massage. No.
Yeah.
Ugh. It really, yeah. So I also hoped that once the claims against him became public and the lawsuits were proceeding and he was kind of kicked out of the United States and he's like, you can't fire me, I quit, you country, that there would be a little bit more on the corporate denouement, and whether law enforcement felt like they wanted to revisit criminal complaints against him and just like a little more unpacking of the fall. Perhaps that wasn't possible, or they sort of wrote it and storyboarded it and it just wasn't working. But
LAPD refused to talk to them. So yeah. It's like, what are you going to do if the cops won't talk to you? Which is like, I mean, I wish they could have said a little bit more about, because that's very unusual that even the PIO won't talk to you. So like, you know, from like sort of like a crime reporter's perspective, which is what I come at, I guess, everything with, you know, I'm sort of like, I would have said more about that. But there are sort of three follow-up post episodes where they talk about the process behind it, which, you know, is I would not necessarily listen to unless you're really into like inside baseball. But if you are and you listen to it, they talk about how they had to make some tough choices on what they had to cut for time and things like that. And one of those things about, you know, like the criminal case, there just wasn't anything to say because the cops wouldn't do anything. So what else are you going to do?
Yeah. And they sort of touched on people, taking the name off the front and so on. But you called for our last clip, which is the Jonathan Whatsitz, the turnaround specialist, who is, I think, primarily his job should be primarily to bail the company out of bankruptcy. But he's also pretty focused on a rebrand that involves female empowerment. So let's hear this clip deep from the interior of Denialistan.
And we're going to show the world that people can come back from these terrible types of problems that this company has had and survive, and not only survive, but thrive. And that's our goal.
How do you, I mean, that sounds like a great goal, but how do you do it with Bikram involved? I mean, how could anything with him still involved the epitome of female empowerment?
When I say involved, he's a shareholder and he was the founder. He did some great things. He did some horrific things. With that said, we're never going to leave the fact that he was the founder and built this company. Ray Kroc is still the founder of McDonald's. Henry Ford was the founder of Ford Motor Company. Now, Henry Ford had some points of view that were anathema to the world. You know what? The name is still on the front of those buildings.
I'm like, why bring Ray Kroc into this? What did he do wrong? I mean, McDonald's isn't great, but he's fine. Jesus Christ, man. But I think the thing is, this guy, okay, so first, you know, if there's that truism, A people hire A people and B people hire C people. And I don't know what kind of person's going to work for Bikram, but it's the same kind of person who's going to agree to work at the Trump White House. And that's why you get people who sound like this. But, you know, like this guy made, you know, the opposite point so elegantly here, that no matter how you try to rebrand the corporate aspect of Bikram, as long as he's involved, and that makes it unworkable. It is extremely easy. If you want to do Bikram yoga, it is extremely easy to find a hot yoga studio in most major cities and many minor ones that doesn't say Bikram anywhere, does not send students to Bikram's teacher training to be raped. And, you know, if you ask the studio head, we'll say, you know, we're so opposed to this, but we know that this is a life-changing, life-saving, you know, form of yoga. And I'm not arguing it's life-changing or life-saving. I'm just saying it was a great workout for me. But, you know, you can find those studios with people who have consciously uncoupled from Bikram. And so that this guy's suggesting it all, that Bikram has to be involved with the actual service element of the yoga, is a fucking joke. No, he doesn't.
Well, and just find a lawyer who's like, that is changing it enough that he won't sue you. And in order to sue you, he'd have to come back to the U.S. And he's not prepared to do that, I'm sure. but just find and then just take the name off it. Like, I mean, I take his point about Henry Ford, but I think it's an extremely disingenuous argument. And there are no stadiums named Enron anymore. And what you're dealing with is, I think, not a... This person built a company that was, you know, I don't think the company was corrupt. And the product was not... The product was not inducing people to... Was not, like, committing crimes. I just don't think it's an exact parallel. And even with all of that, I'm not defending Henry Ford, and I'm not sure that that name should be on the buildings anymore. Maybe they should rename it the Model T Company. I don't know. But just, and at the beginning of the quote, too, when he's like, you know, that we can come back from circumstances like these, like from the founder fucking raping people, like say what happened, say what things are. Ugh. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, because no, but here's the thing. Like, say, you know, you or I decide to mount a Sleeping Giants boycott against the Ford Company tomorrow or something. It would hurt a lot of innocent people. Tons of people work at the Ford Company. You know, if you and I, you know, with our combined powers brought down Ford, you know, so many people would lose jobs and it would really fucking suck. But with Bikram Yoga, this is almost a perfect scenario because studio owners, the regular people, they aren't franchising this thing. They aren't paying Bikram. You know, you can go to any studio after you ask the studio owner, are you sending people to teacher training, and have your conscience be completely clear because you're doing this yoga that's existed, you know, that existed for, you know, many years before Bikram came along. But the only person who's getting fucked if you avoid people who send Bikram's students who go to teacher training is Bikram. So nobody, this isn't a situation like if you decided to cancel Roseanne, for example, and, you know, where all these other people are going to lose their jobs. The only person losing money if Bikram is shut down permanently is Bikram. Everybody else can still have studios, still be yoga instructors, still use the dialogue. If you want to continue to use the dialogue, that's where my twist, your arms like ropes, came from, Sarah. I wasn't actually making a strangulation joke. You know, you can do all that still. People can still practice yoga. You know, regular people can still make as much money as they were before. And everything's fine. So, no, we don't need to rebuild that corporation. All of that is just a craven grab for, you know, the money that Bikram has left after he illegally moved all his cars out of the country.
Mm. Yeah, based on a system that he adapted, Reed stole from someone else. So, yeah, just call it hot yoga and live your lives.
Yeah.
But yeah, yes.
You know what? There are hot yoga studios without carpet now. So go to one of those. I've done both. The ones without carpet, it's so much better.
Well, seriously, that's just like,
yeah,
you can hear the germs seething in the carpet fibers. Yeah. Like, ugh. Was a very informative listen. I didn't know anything about this story. I think that she, that Julia Lowry Henderson is really good at this. Good researcher, good reporter, pleasant to listen to. And I think I'm going to listen to those follow-ups because I am interested to know how the tapestry is knotted on the back. So yeah, that's a 30 for 30 podcast, the Bikram season. And I recommend it. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. Speaking of bringing things to people's attention, Eve, where else can listeners find you?
Well, I would love it if any of you are ever in San Francisco, if you would stop by my retail shop. I've had listeners come in before. It's always delightful. And if I'm not here, my husband Tim is. And you know what? He's actually significantly more likable than I am. So you'll get a better deal if you talk to him instead of me. It's called Avenues Dry Goods. It's called Avenues Dry Goods on all of social media, too. So it's easy to find. You can follow it on Instagram. I barely ever tweet, but you can follow it on Twitter. You know, we're on Facebook. And it's a store that specializes in stuff from local artists and craftspeople. And I promise you'll like it.
Can confirm. That's it for this episode of The Bladder Presents. Until our next installment, if you've got a tip for me, you can find me on social media. That's Bladder Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. Or you can email me. That's bunting@the-bladder.com. You can become an official Bladder tipster at the Bladder's Patreon page. That's patreon.com/bladderpresents. If you like the podcast, I'd love it if you tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so that other listeners can find me. If you don't like the podcast, I'd love it if you didn't tell anyone. My guest has been Eve Beatty, and she's on Twitter at Eve B. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.